The spring allergy season is upon us. That, along with lingering factors contributing to airborne pollution, it's time to buttress your respiratory health with Breathe Clear from my friends at NT Factor. Breathe Clear with NT Factor combines the benefits of NT Factor's breakthrough lipids formula with powerful bioflavonoids and amino acids. Together, they've been shown to restore energy, repair the damage to cells caused by air pollution, decrease allergic reactions, reduce sinus congestion, and open blood vessels. Breathe Clear with NT Factor is the best formulation available for tackling both allergies and the free radical damage caused by air pollution. For a limited time, buy one bottle of Breathe Clear with NT Factor and get another one absolutely free. That's a $27 savings. Just go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com or call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158. Take advantage of this buy one, get one free sale and arm yourself with the protective power of Breathe Clear with NT Factor this spring and breathe freely while supporting your body's fight against allergies and free radicals. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to talk to an investigative journalist, Tom Mueller, about what really amounts to a case study of how American medicine has gone awry. He has a new book entitled How to Make a Killing, Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine. And it sounds pretty lurid, but front and center in that book is a discussion of the dialysis industry. It's a miracle that we now are able to save the lives of people in kidney failure, but how did a miracle turn into a nightmare? And that's really the theme of the book. It's beautifully written. Tom is a freelance writer of nonfiction and fiction as well. He studied at Oxford. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He also got a BA at Harvard. He's summa cum laude there. And he has had a very, very interesting career traveling all over the world, living and working in 48 countries. And his most recent book, How to Make a Killing, is a look at the shocking world of the U.S. healthcare industry through the lens of the dialysis establishment, where, in effect, a miracle cure has become a nightmare for the many sufferers of what's called end-stage renal disease. So, without further ado, here's Tom Mueller. Tom, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. The book is great. It's very readable. It kind of reads like a detective novel because, you know, you go into the history of how kidney disease was originally a very, very, very virtually a death sentence, and how through the miracle of dialysis, people's lives have been saved. But the net result has not been the most auspicious one for sufferers of kidney disease. So thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman. It's great to be here.
So first of all, you know, let's talk a little bit about the prevalence of kidney disease, because this is a big problem, and it's a mounting problem, because the diseases that tend to trigger kidney failure are on the upswing, right? What are some of the statistics on that?
No, exactly. I mean, kidney disease is an epidemic. The National Kidney Foundation estimates that something like 37 million Americans have some degree of kidney disease, and only 10% even know it, which is a bit of a shocker. And it's driven by underlying epidemics, as you suggest, hypertension, diabetes, obesity. And so it's really kind of the disease of our times in terms of the number of people who are getting pulled into it, and unfortunately also in terms of the type of care, for extremely for-profit and monopolized care that's being provided to a lot of people who actually go to the end stage disease, I call it, when their kidneys actually fail and they need either a transplant or dialysis.
So let's back up a little bit, because let's talk a little bit about what the kidneys do and what happens when the kidneys fail, because we now have dialysis and people are hooked up to essentially what is a filter. And it seems like a straightforward proposition, you know, like the kidneys filter out impurities, you pee out the bad stuff, you retain the good stuff, no big deal. But how is it that the complexity of what the kidneys do sometimes defies a simple fix?
Yeah, it seems like when you say kidneys are a filter, that's true. And it seems like a straightforward set of problems that it's solving. And in fact, apart from removing substances, many, many, many toxic byproducts that we avoid, you know, byproducts of our metabolism that we avoid in urine. And I talk about the miracle of urine is another thing I discovered while writing this. I mean, I took it for granted, almost resented it, and now I cherish it. But, you know, kidneys also remove excess fluid from the blood, which is another key thing, which sadly, even many low-level kidney care specialists forget. They just think of, you know, urea, the one toxic byproduct, mm-hmm. as the key. And there are dozens, scores. But yeah, removes excess fluid, also creates manufactures a number of key hormones and vitamins that control body processes like red blood cell production, blood pressure regulation, we're talking about hypertension, and bone building. So kidneys really are a kind of a mysterious, again, in ancient times, a lot of ancient civilizations really kind of downplayed the kidney. Everyone knows about the heart, the brain, you know, the liver sometimes was the seat of the soul. But kidneys kind of got short shrift. But in reality, they are kind of the architects of what is called the homeostasis. I mean, our sort of equilibrium of our fluid environment. There's a great French physiologist who I ran into while reading this, ran into his writings. He's Claude died Bernard.
Right.
Claude Bernard, exactly. Yeah. And he's probably someone with whom you are very familiar with, but I had blessed to say I hadn't met him before. But his concept of the milieu antérieur, the interior balance, the delicately regulated fluid environment surrounds our cells and courses through our arteries and veins that really makes our, you know, a life possible. The idea that there's an interior balance, equilibrium, and then the exterior world goes on its merry way. But what's happening inside the envelope of our flesh is really the key thing. And kidneys are sort of the architects of that homeostasis. They're the conductors of the great symphony of life.
I sometimes liken it to, you know, it's kind of easy to have a freshwater aquarium. You know, you just get some fresh water and you put the fish in and it's generally okay. But when you try to do a saltwater aquarium, I don't know if you've ever been an aquarium enthusiast, but my dad was, it was always very tricky to keep the fish alive. And because there's in the ocean, there's an ecosystem. You know, it's the right pH. There's the plants. There's the fish. They kind of coexist. As long as you don't dump a lot of pollutants into the ocean, things are okay. But in an artificial environment, it is very tricky to maintain the pH, the mineral concentration, the homeostasis between the plants and the fish, and things can go awry very quickly. And that's the kidneys are there to establish that, you know, to keep the mineral balance, to keep the pH, to keep the sodium, the potassium, all these various things in line. And when you don't have good kidney function, well, it's hard to imagine that a machine could simply replicate the exquisitely delicate tweaking that the kidneys do from moment to moment through in the body.
Yeah, exactly. And the challenge of producing a machine that could keep people alive long enough for their kidneys to restart, and to say nothing of actually replacing them, was one of the great medical triumphs starting in World War II times, when both civilians and especially combatants were plagued with kidney failure of all sorts. But it's one of these great kind of Rube Goldberg problems that several very creative medical doctors, but also gifted tinkerers and inventors, Pim Kolff in wartime Holland in particular, cobbled together these elaborate contraptions that would filter using sausage casings for filters and, you know, pieces from downed aircraft, a piece of plexiglass from an American bomber that had landed nearby. And really, It was the first time in history that anyone had replaced a vital organ with a machine. So it was a huge medical breakthrough. The only problem was that these contraptions, they weren't very efficient, perhaps not as sterile as one might want. But the big problem was the actual connection to the circulatory system of the patient that you could only do it a few times before you ran out of. It's basically a surgical procedure to attach this machine to the patient. And if their kidneys didn't restart within X number of surgical procedures, they ran out of access points.
Yeah, so it's actually a fascinating story that you document there, is that literally there was this tremendous innovation that occurred under duress during wartime in Europe, some of it in Netherlands, where they were experiencing tremendous privation and even famine, and yet they were able to come up with this very exciting innovation. And I guess it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was in the 60s and 70s that this technology really emerged as something that could be administered on a mass basis, right?
Exactly. That machine that Tim Kolff created was perfected at the Brigham in Boston. The great early nephrologist, back before there was nephrology, the early nephrologists led by Belding Scribner at the University of Washington perfected the access, the Scribner shunt. So you had a much better machine, and now you could attach it repeatedly to the patient. And yeah, the late 60s and early 70s was an incredible breakthrough. And it turned a death sentence of a few days into potentially living for decades. Needless to say, the demand spiked and far outpaced the supply of the very few operating kidneys and very, very few dialysis centers at that time in the late 60s and early 70s, to the point where they actually had, I mean, death, real life death panels. They called it administrative acceptance panels, but what in reality was a group of people, non-medical people for the most part, lawyers, bankers, a clergyman, deciding who would live and who would die. And the ones they chose for treatment lived sometimes for decades, and the majority they chose not to treat died. And the fact that they chose people, non-medical people, that this is a hospital, also Belding Scribner, it was part of the kickstarting of the whole new field of bioethics. It was this huge debate, which eventually reached Congress, and that's where we're going with this. The reason that dialysis today is the only major Medicare for all program in the nation is because back in 1972, Richard Nixon, of all people, signed a bipartisan law that made, you know, dialysis and kidney transplant, made end-stage renal disease or kidney failure the target of what was thought to be the first step in a national health program. Everyone at that point, the Republicans, the Democrats, the insurance companies, the AMA, everybody thought the next stage, the next step was going to be national health for everybody. And then along came, you know, the cratering of the Vietnam War and stagflation and the OPEC oil embargo, and the entire nation shifted from sort of great society to let's cut costs. And basically we've been there ever since with neoliberalism, Reaganomics coming in and saying, let's cut costs, and while we're at it, cut taxes, which is a sort of contradiction, but there it is.
So this Dialysis for All Act that was passed in 1972, maybe that's a euphemism, that's not what it's called, but in essence, that's what it offered, is dialysis for the hundreds of thousands of people who were literally dependent on dialysis for life support, so that it gave them the right to receive this therapy via whatever insurance they had, or via Medicare, or via Medicaid, you know, patients who were impoverished, patients who were of means. It kind of leveled the playing field. But there were unintended consequences of this, because it kind of led to the commercialization of dialysis. As so often happens in capitalism, there were opportunities there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty captive audience. If you want return customers, kidney failure patients are pretty good ones, because if they don't get treatment three times a week as a sort of baseline, they're going to die on you. Oh, so if you can make money from that, and if the government is signing the bills, which is a real unique thing in the American system, then it is how to make a killing. And I chose that title advisedly with a little bit of trepidation, because I interviewed countless patients and countless workers who I did not want to offend or shock. But at the end of the day, I really feel like the what's going on in dialysis today is shocking, is a killing, and the double entendre is richly deserved. But also, I think it's a perfect microcosm of what's going wrong in American healthcare more broadly, the financialization, the monopoly power wielded by the two leading companies, and the lack of, you know, plausible regulation and regulatory power. These are things that are happening all over. I mean, Congress has really gotten worked up about lately about private equity buying out large chunks of American medicine, and they're right to be worked up. But this is 25 years old, folks. This has been going on in dialysis. The same mechanisms have been going on in dialysis for the last quarter century. So I think it is a really, really good microcosm. And since it is a Medicare for the one and only Medicare for all program in America, I think it's a very good starting point for, you know, a very hard look at America that the currently impossible to fund. On the one hand, it's non-sustainable economically, but also our results. I mean, they're two hockey sticks. Our costs are going through the roof, and our results are dropping to the bottom of the developed world. So
that's overall for healthcare in America. Our health statistics are fairly abysmal for industrialized countries, but our expenditures per capita are astronomical compared to other countries. But dialysis per se, the outcomes have been rated internationally, and cost is greater in the United States, and quality of life and other outcomes, mortality, et cetera, are worse for U.S. dialysis patients.
That's correct, Dr. Hoffman. Yeah, all of those things are true, even though they seem contradictory. I mean, mortality, take one, is right around 20% per year, the worst in the industrialized world in the United States. In Japan, it's 5-6% per year. Western Europe, 9-12% per year. We can go around. We can even choose some countries that are not fully developed, and they still do better. And it comes back down to, I mean, you know, I lay this all out in my book. And I should say that I shared some of the stronger statements with a number of the companies that I call out. I did get some responses, and I included those responses in my book. So people should read my book, look at the 60 pages of end notes, and draw their own conclusions. But according to my reporting and my research, one of the major problems here is that the industry is run by two very large publicly quoted corporations that have profit as their primary objective. You know, Warren Buffett owns 40% of DaVita. Fresenius is a very for-profit corporation, as are, you know, and if it's one thing if you're making widgets, but this is very delicate, despite the fact that it's in the mall and it's in industrial parks all over the country. This is delicate stuff. Get it wrong and people die. And that's unfortunately what's happening in America far too often.
So you talk about the strip mallization of dialysis, you know, originally conceived of something to be performed in tertiary medical centers, university hospital centers of excellence, and yet they because of the opportunities, they spread like wildfire into sometimes less than, shall we say, optimal facilities. Basically, kind of, we could call them dialysis chop shops.
I've heard them called the Jiffy Lubes, and I've heard it described as cattle call dialysis. I've seen dialysis facilities next to nursing homes on the one hand, and mortuaries on the other, or funeral homes on the other. These are places where very delicate medicine that was once, as you say, done in hospitals in a safe environment from a medical point of view are now done in the mall, and in many cases, and by people in many cases who are doing the all important stick, who are doing the dialysis techs, don't get a whole lot of training before they stick these 12-gauge needles into people's major blood vessels. This is dangerous. I mean, I've read some 911 calls from California where a great deal of research has been done on what's going on in dialysis facilities. And the 911 call transcripts are hair raising. I mean, people calling and saying, "He's not breathing. Well, do CPR. How?" This is where
wow.
we are.
Wow.
So, and you know, just because it's done in the mall doesn't mean it should be done in the mall. Taking a step back, you asked how this profit thing came in. I mean, on the one hand, back in the 70s, when dialysis became Medicare for all, there were two kind of schools of thought, and they duped it out in Congress. And the Seattle crew, led by Belding Scribner, was all about not-for-profit, community centers, community-funded, slow, gentle, and ideally at-home dialysis. That was their model. And ultimately, that was the model Congress bought into when they said, okay, will fund, you know, kidney, will fund dialysis for every American with kidney failure. The other model was the Brigham Harvard Medical School model, which became National Medical Care. That spun off into a for-profit corporation. And they had the complete, they were really Reaganomics driven. They, I mean, their whole line was, we need to have the profit motive set front and center in the doctor's practice of medicine. They need to be investors in their own facility. Only then will they
properly. Incentivized, yeah, okay.
Exactly, incentivized. And they had never heard of, literally, or if they had, they didn't admit perverse incentives. They just got the incentive part. Now, in their to their favor and in their defense, in the early days, people needed dialysis centers as quickly as possible. People were dying because of the, you know, death panels and all these other things. They were real. People were dying for lack of treatment. So rolling out a bunch of facilities and setting, you know, some standards by some very eminent Harvard-trained doctors was a good thing at first. But like many good things, when the money became the really sort of overarching concern, and when NMC became public, and then, you know, it ultimately profits came before patients, and that was, but the Boston model triumphed over the Seattle model, and ultimately National Medical Care and Gambro and various other major corporations were gradually Pac-Maned up into the duopoly that we have today, DaVita on the one hand and Fresenius on the other.
You know, when private equity enters the picture, often what happens is there's the bean counters take precedence over the health professionals. And what then you see ultimately is cost containment to the detriment of the patients. So low wages and adverse working conditions can contribute to poor quality care and even outright patient abuse. Because if you hire people who are poorly trained and they have poor morale, these centers become kind of hellish.
Yeah. And I mean, on the one hand, if you're telling them you got to get the patients on and off the machines in 15 minutes, but it says on the manual an hour, I said 15 minutes. And if you don't do it, you're out. Mm-hmm. You're forcing people to do stuff, you know, by time and by, and you, you know, give them bonuses if they do it, and you dock them or fire them if you don't. On the other hand, you're really putting people who care deeply about this. I mean, I interviewed one fellow, Magellan Hanford, who's really one of my heroes, former LAPD patrolman, who retrained as a dialysis nurse. He's worked for Fresenius and DaVita both, particularly in California. He's moved on since then. He moved to Texas, and he says things are very different. But at the time, he was talking about, you know, how his it sounded to me like moral injury or from being forced to take
burnout.
Part in this
burnout.
Sort of
this is a recipe for burnout. Yeah.
And you know, he would talk about, well, you know, like we used to say in the police, I feel I'm here to protect and to serve, but now given how the industry operates, I'm not able to do either. And he's talking about, you know, moving from one patient to another and saying, are you still breathing? Okay, good. And moving on to the next one, you know, getting dozens of patients at one time, patients dying and being just covered by a sheet as they continued their work on the other patient. I mean, again, this is really serious, life-threatening treatment that is being done high speed at the mall. One Australian nephrologist calls it bazooka dialysis, which is somewhat reductive. But if you're focusing on very short treatment times and high ultrafiltration rate, ripping the fluid out of the blood, that it reminds him of a bazooka, and unfortunately, it has some of the same consequences.
All right. Good point at which to pause, because we've laid down the groundwork for our discussion in part two. We're going to talk about some of the unforeseen consequences of our rush to provide dialysis in a fair and equitable way via a system that inherently is driven by profits. The book, and it's kind of I really think it's a great microcosm of our healthcare system in general, focusing on kidney disease, but more generalizable to our medical system overall. The book is How to Make a Killing, Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine. Our guest, its author, Tom Muller. Tom and I will be back with part two in just a moment, so stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.